originally the market advanced after Jay Powell had indicated or suggested through the dot plot exposure from the Federal Reserve governors that there were going to be a series of cuts starting in March, and the market really was counting on that. And that's when you began to see the equities market shoot up. There really hasn't been a correction since then.
Welcome to What Matters, brought to you by MA Financial Group. I'm your host, Tom Brown. November's US election will have huge implications for the economy and capital markets this year and going forward. To break it down and get a unique perspective from someone on the ground and in the know, we're joined by Eric Cantor. Of course, I speak of the Vice Chairman and Managing Director at Moelis & Company. Moelis, for context, has a circa $4 billion US market cap over in the States. Eric, in his previous professional life, the Republican representative for Virginia in the US House of Representatives from 2001 to 2014, including 4 years as the House Majority Leader. Eric knows how the corridors of power work in Washington because he's worked them. Eric, welcome. We're in the Sydney studio. I see on the return monitor, you're sitting above Park Avenue in New York.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
Andrew Pridham needs no introduction for listeners of What Matters. Of course, the co-founder of MA Financial, the vice chairman of the group and chairman of the Sydney Swans. Andrew, welcome. How are you?
I'm well, Tom. Great to see you.
Very good. Now, there's lots on the agenda. The US economy, interest rates, if the bull run in equities markets is sustainable at the moment. But the hot topic off the top is politics. Eric, you've got incredible perspective on this. How do you see things currently playing out with these primaries?
Well, you know, you never know. In politics, there is the constant threat of uncertainty, for sure. But what it looks like now, as we are well into the primary season for each party to nominate their candidates, it looks like we're going to have just a redo of what we saw in 2020. It will be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump again, in my opinion. We'll have to see how everything plays out. But I think what you're going to see is Donald Trump solidifying his lead and wrapping up, if you will, the delegate count sometime in the maybe late March. He'll have sufficient delegates to go to the convention this summer in Milwaukee. And obviously on the Democratic side, very, very, very unlikely that the nominee there will be anyone but President Joe Biden. So I do think it's looking like we're going to have a rematch.
It's a fascinating drama unfolding for us here in Australia watching on, and I know our perspectives are probably pretty poor. Joe Biden's cognitive position seems to be something that does bewilder Australians as to how do you see that as a factor?
You know, Andrew, it is bewildering to us here in America as well. And as someone like me, I think as Tom said in the introduction, who spent really almost 25 years in elected office between the state level in Virginia and then in Congress. I will say it is our system, unlike Australia's, it suffers from the lack of participation all the way through. And as I've always marveled at your system, where there is compulsory attendance at polling places, meaning I guess you don't have to vote, but you got to show up. We don't have that. So the reason for the difficulty in our primary process is really only 10% of voters who are eligible even bother to participate, which is why, again, the extremes in each party have such an outsized impact on selection of the nominees and an outsized impact on what they talk about, because that is the crowd that the nominees need to become nominated in the party's candidate. Once that happens, because of our electoral college and our system, it is very, very unlikely that a third party would ever be successful. Therefore, it's a binary system. It's one or the other. And so it's hard for me to even understand why people wouldn't get involved, because big decisions are made for the general public by even 10% of the population that hands up this choice to the general election.
Eric, I've often wondered about that. I mean, America isn't necessarily ageist, which is a good thing. There's a lot of older, successful professionals in America. We see it in business and sport. Andy Reid, for example, just won his third Super Bowl in his mid-60s. But Biden's 81, and even Trump is no spring chicken. I think he's 77 or so. Why aren't we seeing younger presidential candidates like Clinton or Obama or even George Bush Jr.?
Well, I just think we're in a very unique time in America. I mean, number one, on the Donald Trump side, I mean, he is and maintains a much more youthful profile. He's very robust and active physically. And as you see on video, TV, broadcast, the rest, I mean, he's very robust and very forceful in his presence and his rhetoric. And Biden's just not that way. I mean, having served with him and know him personally, he has really lost more than just a step. And as the special prosecutor's report last week indicated, the prosecutor said he was not going to press charges against the president for any type of mishandling of classified documents because he was an old man with bad memory. And that does speak to the sort of, you know, outrageous type of result we're getting in our system, but it is what it is. I think the power of incumbency is going to outweigh anything else. The Democrats believe this is an incumbent president. He is obviously well known, almost 100%, I'm sure, name ID in the country. And they're going to make this about Donald Trump. And as I said before, Donald Trump is a very unusual figure. There's no one else like him. And he has been able to assume a role in American politics and for the Republican Party that is the strongest rebuke, if you will, to the establishment and very much reflecting that populist ire that exists in our country today.
And just two more on politics, if I could, Eric. I guess very relevant to Australia. What would be the difference in a Trump administration and a Biden administration regarding trade and foreign policy, which has obviously been put on the agenda recently in regards to Trump's comments on NATO? And I know Australia has a very unique alliance with America as well, which is important vis-a-vis our relationship with China.
Well, I will say, and I think we've spoken about this before when I've been in your great country, that in any public poll, when asked, Americans will say our best ally is Australia. So I don't think anything happens to the U.S.-Australia alliance if either one is elected. I think that remains as strong and as close as it is now. I do think, though, we could do a better job in leading on the issue of trade. And unfortunately, both parties have sort of stepped back from a very aggressive posture in terms of signing multilateral agreements, bilateral agreements. Again, this goes back to a very nationalistic and almost protectionist type of attitude towards trade right now. And Donald Trump is famous for his stance with the iconic industries and wanting to bring back manufacturing and the steel industries and the other big manufacturing industries that in many cases have gone overseas where labor is cheaper, costs are lower. So I think from a trade standpoint, you probably are not going to see that much of a difference. I think Donald Trump will be much more inclined to want to impose tariffs. I don't think this will necessarily apply to Australia, but I do think it's certainly going to be aimed at your neighbor to the north in China. He's already come out verbally and said certainly a 10% across the board, if not a 60% tariff on Chinese goods. So I think you're going to see an increase heating up of the rhetoric and probably the policy under a Trump administration.
You're sitting above Park Avenue in New York, which is Donald Trump heartland, if you like, certainly from a business and, I guess, property perspective, Eric. But you mentioned before your political career goes back some way, including it. One of the highest positions, if you like, in U.S. government. How regularly do you deal with Trump? Like, do you speak to him regularly, or how does all that work?
No, you know, we're a big country now, right? And so it's a he's you know, Donald Trump now, he's left New York City, as you know, and I think he bemoans that, but he's left it for many reasons. He lives in Florida. He's a resident of Palm Beach now, and he runs his campaign out of Florida. Interestingly enough, some of the people I grew up with in Republican politics in Virginia, one in particular, is one of the main sort of leaders of his campaign effort. So there is just a very focused operation politically. Donald Trump, the candidate, is as engaged politically in that campaign and what goes on. And he's ultimately a promoter and a performer. And I think that's what you have with Donald Trump. I know Ken Mollis has had a lot of interaction with Donald. I know he could probably opine more about him personally, but I don't interact with him personally.
Well, we might hear about the coin tossing incident a little later, but is the election, Eric, in your learned opinion, is it a toss of a coin, or are we likely to see a landslide?
Oh, no, this is going to be incredibly close, Andrew. This is going to be just like 2016 and 2020. If you remember, those elections in 2016 between Hillary and Donald Trump was decided really in a handful of states by about 67,000 voters. In 2020, it was an equal number of small number of states, about 45,000 voters. This time, I think it's most likely comes down to four states that will really matter, and they were four of the five that flipped their vote from 16 to 20, and those were Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia. And frankly, given the polarization and given the performance of the parties over the last decade plus, we know that the Democratic Party is going to do really well in the urban areas and the cities in those states. And we know that my party, the Republicans, will do much better in the ex-urban and rural areas. So it really does come down to the big suburban swing counties in those four states. It's incredible to think that in a country of 335-plus million people, that it's going to come down to this small number of voters, because every other state pretty much has established its habits. People have congregated with others who vote and think like they do. So pretty much you've got red and blue states, unless you look at these four. And there may be a couple of others, but I think it's these four. And so it'll be very, very close. And the issues that are, you know, that will energize the electorate in these four counties and four states really are going to be abortion, big hot issue still in this country, given a Supreme Court ruling last year called the Dobbs case. It's going to be the Democrats' call for Trump's threat to democracy. Those are the two that will favor a Democratic turnout. On the Republican side, it'll be about immigration. I'm sure you've been reading the news about our problem with the southern border out of control, and as well as the crime issue and public safety issue in the aftermath of the race riots during the pandemic and the rest. It's still a lingering issue in many, many places. So those tend to benefit Republicans, but I do think it's going to come down to such a small universe of voters, be very, very close.
And as, prominent as Trump is in the media and obviously his commentary and so forth, from a Biden perspective, Eric, does Biden worry about Trump, or does he think he sort of got his measure, for want of a better word?
You know, Biden and Biden advisors are really worried because, number one, you mentioned earlier, his age. He is just not spry by any means. He is just under such scrutiny about his age and unfitness, if you will, for office. So they are worried. And you can see on this immigration issue, even when a bipartisan effort to solve that problem passed the Senate, or it did not pass the Senate, but came close, Biden is now looking at picking that issue back up and trying to sign an executive order to accomplish the same thing, because they sense that Trump's got a real winning issue on immigration. So they're very worried about it. I think their whole campaign is going to be not about Biden's and what he's done, his track record. It's going to be all on the attack of Donald Trump, because honestly, the Democrats feel the best turnout mechanism they've got is Donald Trump. It's not Joe Biden himself.
How do you see the vice presidential candidates playing into the dynamics?
You know, you have to think that anybody who's going to vote for Joe Biden has got to wonder how long he'll be around. And so I think in that calculation is going to be the thought that, oh, wait a minute, if I'm voting for Joe Biden, I'm really voting for Kamala Harris. And I probably it's not too big of a stretch to think that of any voter for Joe Biden is probably going to vote for Kamala Harris, whereas she is just toxic on my side of the aisle and could even generate more ire to push turnout knowing that she would be behind Biden. On the Republican side, you know, Donald Trump is it's going to be his pick if he's the nominee. The rumors lately are that in first place is J.D. Vance right now, the senator from Ohio, recent senator, junior senator from Ohio, who wrote a book called Hillbilly Elegy several years ago. It's really resonated with the so-called MAGA base and the real populist sort of nationalistic fervor that's growing in our country. But also there's discussion about Tucker Carlson, which is an interesting discussion. I'm not sure it's for real, but he's certainly really influential on the right.
That's certainly key. His name obviously comes up prominently in the recent books about Murdoch and all the rest of it. In terms of, look, it comes up in the popular press, but just for some perspective, Michelle Obama, was she ever going to run, Eric, or would she ever consider running? Or did they? How serious was that debate? Or discussion, I should say.
I think it's all rumor. I don't think she would ever run. And if she did, she would certainly be the Democrats' most formidable candidate. Because you got to remember, too, in America, the Democratic Party, their most important activist base, meaning the people who turn out in the primaries and are reliable voters in the general election, is the black community. And the African-American community makes up probably nationally 25% of the Democratic political base. And you really need them to turn out. There's no one that could make them turn out and get them to turn out like she could. But I think it's a very low likelihood.
Just changing pace a little bit, Eric. I'm a great lover of the United States. I'm often in New York and LA. Lawlessness seems to have really taken charge, particularly in my observation in California, but also in New York. What do you see as a solution to this problem, and how do you see Trump dealing with that versus a Biden?
Well, I think you're right, Andrew, that, you know, LA in particular and San Francisco, you know, they have prosecutors that are elected in those states and in those localities that have decided that they, for whatever reason, if they're not staffed up enough or they don't believe that they should go after and prosecute any type of misdemeanor under $1,000. And you can imagine what that does to sort of moral fabric of a community if all of a sudden you have a Whole Foods grocery store, a Walgreens drugstore, what have you, on the corner in an urban setting in San Francisco or LA, that you're inviting people to go in and providing an incentive for them to do something untoward and illegal. And that's exactly what's happened in those areas. You also have in LA County alone, I think I've read recently, there's a population of 60,000 homeless people. And they allow this to occur. All the while you have taxpaying citizens who pay taxes to enjoy a clean and safe community, and yet they can't quite seem to get their governance and politics straight. That's what needs to be taken care of. And again, it's all about, you know, these big cities are controlled by the Democratic Party. They have this progressive left ideology that has infused their politics and the way that they govern. Here in New York, it's not as extreme because the New York mayor is a former police officer, NYPD. He's also served in Albany, the state capital in New York. He understands the importance of public safety to economic progress and growth. So it's you tend to see in New York it's a little bit more under control. But again, so much of this stemmed from during the pandemic when there were all the lockdowns, certainly nowhere near like your country, but the lockdowns and then the race riots that came after the George Floyd murder or killing, and the backlash that occurred. And remember, there was this hue and cry from the Democratic Party back then about defund the police force. I mean, how crazy is that? Again, the Democratic Party has disowned that, or they've tried to now, but that's all part of how I think we've gotten to where we are.
Eric, you won't, this will go over your head, but Tom, my last trip to LA was sort of akin to walking through the dirty streets of Collingwood.
Collingwood's our premiership AFL side here in Australia.
We won't talk about that.
But it's a rough and tough area.
You've made the huge move from politics to the far more, I guess, socially giving enterprise of investment banking. What is your perspective on the impact of on the economy and, I guess, corporate activity with either a Biden or a Trump win?
Well, I think that with certainly different from either, but also what can really magnify a difference is if Congress were to flip. Because right now, as you remember, House is controlled narrowly by Republicans and the Senate by Democrats. The conventional wisdom is that the Senate will flip to Republican and that the House could flip. But let's say the House holds Republican and the Senate goes Republican and Donald Trump wins and you have a unified Republican government in Washington, you're going to see a lot of difference in terms of what comes out of D.C. because you'll have the potential for statutory change. And I would say just two things in particular to look out for from a business standpoint. One is the IRA bill. And I know you probably heard about that bill. It is a tremendous trillion-dollar-plus bill that is in pursuit of industrial policy that is aimed towards promoting the green agenda. And it's the green economy, especially as it relates to transition to EVs, electric vehicles. And there's also more incentives around renewable power and the rest. I think that is first up on the chopping block if Republicans control and are unified in Washington. And there will be, secondly, a forcing mechanism to bring all this to the fore, and that is the expiration of the Trump tax cuts. Without getting into the detail as to why these tax cuts weren't permanent, they expire for the most part in at the end of 2025, so a year after a new president and Congress are sworn in. That will bring up a huge fiscal discussion because there'll be a lot of pressure on the fiscal and the federal budget. Interest rates, you know, depending on where they are, and we think obviously now it seems like there's not going to be any increases, at least that's where people are betting from the Federal Reserve standpoint, but we may stay where we are. And if we do, the interest bill on the federal debt is enormous. And is in fact, last fiscal year, which ended September 30th, it was $791 billion, U.S. dollars, for last year. I mean, that is as much as we spend on our Medicaid program, which is for senior indigent care, almost as much as we pay on our Medicare program, which is for all seniors, and getting close to our defense budget, which is $880-some billion a year. So there'll be a lot of fiscal pressure and choices to be made, and I do think that Republicans have already demonstrated that they will choose straight up to cut a lot of these green subsidies in favor of lowering taxes for people.
And just moving topic slightly, Eric, I'm mindful you're probably going to get back to Washington, so I've got you for about another 2 minutes. I'll just go with a couple of extra questions. The S&P is at a record high. I think it might even eclipse that again today. NVIDIA exceeded earnings expectations, I think, by some degree, sending their share price rallying some $280 billion in market cap overnight. How do you see this multi-month bull rally in the equity markets? What's the sentiment regarding that in America at the moment?
You know, I think it's, you know, it was originally the market advanced after Jay Powell had indicated or suggested through the dot plot exposure from the Federal Reserve governors that there were going to be a series of cuts starting in March. And the market really was counting on that. And that's when you began to see the equities market shoot up. There really hasn't been a correction since then in terms of where I think people are now, which investors are looking to say, hey, we may stay higher for longer. But again, it's been the erasing of this so-called tail risk that there could be interest rate increases. And so when nobody's betting on that, I think this sort of almost return to some sense of certainty is giving investors more hope. And obviously, you mentioned NVIDIA, you know, the whole AI craze is also something that has excited investors, whether they're retail or whether they're institutional investors, because of the hope and promise that AI has for increasing productivity, you know, throughout our economy and all the potential job creation, wealth creation that holds. So, you know, I think from my standpoint, I am very optimistic going forward that with a stronger equities market and more certainty around the cost of capital and financing, that we're going to see an upswing as we get towards the middle and back half of this year.
Certainly some optimism there and great perspective from Eric on the state of the U.S. markets. Andrew, you're right across this. I know you're an avid follower of everything in the United States. How do you sort of see the political landscape this year and in particular its impact on markets?
Well, Tom, look, I really agree with, you know, what Eric has said. I mean, he's unrivaled in his knowledge of the electoral dynamics in the United States. And I think I agree with one thing in particular, and that is optimism. And, he, you know, seeing that there's likely to be an upswing in the economy later this year, I do agree with that. Eric clearly sees the election being incredibly tight, really decided by four states. I think the most significant dynamic in terms of outcomes will be whether there's an alignment within the Senate and the House of Representatives. I think that will change the shape of the economy and the speed of change. And I think very clearly the Republicans' focus will be immigration, the economy, inflation, and probably to dial down the speed of which we move towards green transition, or the US moves toward green transition, which I think has a positive on markets and the economy. The Democrats obviously will be more focused on things like green transition and the social issues. So the politics of it is quite different. If there's not alignment between the Senate and the House of Representatives, I think not much changes at all. If you want to be Machiavellian, which sometimes you can be in life, you could see Jerome Powell wanting to drop rates before the election to try and help a Democratic win. But we'll see what happens there. I think interest rates, overall, my view is the markets are overly optimistic on falling interest rates. But I think inevitably we are going to see that certainly sometime this year, maybe the back end of this year. And the result of that, I think we're likely to see an improving economy and improving markets. But my sense, notwithstanding Eric's view that it's a very tight race, my sense is the most likely outcome is actually a comprehensive win for the Republicans. And I think that the fact that Trump has been successful in securing the Supreme Court ruling that his call for immunity over the last election, the outcome of the last election in terms of what occurred, I think is pretty significant. So it means a lot of the legal roadblocks that the media tends to focus on are likely to be unresolved by the time that the election occurs.
Andrew, more great insight. Eric, I know you've got a plane to catch back to Washington. Good luck. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for listening to this latest episode of What Matters.
A real pleasure. Hope to see you in person soon.
Thanks for listening to What Matters. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast via Apple or Spotify, or visit us at mafinancial.com. We'll be right back.